Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice, that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the U.S. mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Fahm and is continued in his memory. This is John Roberts. The new Israeli nation-state law continues to gain international focus and condemnation. Though Israel chafes at the mere hint that it is an apartheid state, the nation-state law boldly states in Israeli law the legal structure for an apartheid state. In the age of Trump and Netanyahu, where black is white and up is down, the so-called only democratic state in the Middle East is, by law, a classic apartheid and anti-democratic state. It is now set down in black and white in the Israeli law books. This week, we again take a long and hard look at what this law really does, the society it sets by law, and in particular, what it means to the Palestinian people living under occupation in this apartheid state. This morning, we hear a presentation by Alice Rothschild and Fadi Khoury, recorded at the Community Church of Boston. Their focus? The effects of the nation-state law. Old friend Alice Rothschild is a retired physician who now spends her time writing books and articles on the Middle East, making films and speaking throughout the country. Fadi Khoury is a civil and political rights attorney with the Adala Law Center in Haifa. He also is a doctoral candidate at the Harvard Law School. Here are Alice Rothschild and Fadi Khoury speaking on the Israeli nation-state law.
So it's great to be back with my homies here. So I was asked to speak about the context and the content of the nation-state law that was passed by the Israeli Knesset in July of this year. So just to give you a sense of context, many of you are certainly aware that Israel's institutional discrimination against Palestinian citizens has been well documented, including even by the U.S. State Department and a host of independent rights or experts. This discrimination impacts on many areas of life, including where citizens can live, family life in terms of family reunification policies, employment opportunities, permitting, resources, and a host of other things. The Jewish nation state law states, quote, that the right to exercise national self-determination in the state of Israel is unique to the Jewish people. But I think it's important to understand that this has actually always been the case in Israel. And I'm going to give you an example around land issues. So in 2012, the UN Special Rapporteur noted that Israeli authorities have long pursued what they called a land development model that excludes, discriminates against, and displaces minorities. The UN Committee on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination has similarly noted that, quote, the enactment of a number of discriminatory laws on land issues which disproportionately affect non-Jewish communities is part of the policies of the state. So the Israel already has hundreds of such segregated communities, and a lot of this is thanks to the role of what are called admission committees, where there's an issue of what's called social compatibility, which is a code word for are you an Arab or are you not an Arab. In 2008, Human Rights Watch reported on how these committees function. And basically, they filter potential residents in hundreds of rural Israeli communities. These committees are made up of government and community representatives, as well as senior officials in the Jewish agency, and have notoriously been used to exclude Arabs from living in rural Jewish communities. In 2014, Israel's Supreme Court upheld a law allowing for these committees, and this is a decision that Adala, which Fadi works with, said basically legalizes the principle of segregation in housing. and permits the practice of racism against Arab citizens in about 434 communities, or 43% of all the towns in Israel. Another example of institutional discrimination was recorded in the Israeli newspaper Haaretz, where they said the aim of the new law is to, quote, lay the groundwork for the Supreme Court to give preference to Israel's Jewish character over its democratic values to the two conflict in the courts. But I think we have to be clear that this is something the court already can do and has done. So how does this look? There is another basic law called the Law of Human Dignity and Liberty, and this covers a host of things such as the protection of life, body, dignity, property, privacy, confidentiality. There's a whole list of things that sound good to be protected.
Could you just say what a basic law is?
I'm going to.
Oh, sorry.
Okay. And the caveat to this basic law is that this all happens within the values of the state of Israel as a Jewish and democratic state. And every time you hear that comment, Jewish and democratic, I want you to think about, is it really possible to be both Jewish and democratic? But what this means is that when the justices interpret this clause in the basic law, they do so in such a way to give what they call significant weight to the nature of Israel as a Jewish state and its goals at the expense of fundamental rights. As the former Supreme Court President Aharon Barak said in 1995, we are different from other nations. We are not only a democratic state, but also a Jewish state. So the Jewish nation state law serves to anchor ongoing racist practices at the level of a constitutional law, but these policies are actually not new. Politically speaking, I think the law can only be really understood in the context of the concerted effort of Palestinian citizens of Israel who've been trying to assert their national identity and mobilize against discrimination, and critically, to demand a state for all their citizens. So let me now do a bit of content, and I'm going to do it with a bit of analysis. So what is a basic law? A basic law is a law in Israel that has the weight of constitutional law, because Israel does not have a constitution. There are about a dozen basic laws, including the basic law of human dignity that I just referred to. As we review the content of this law, I want you to think about a couple of important points. The first is that you will see that there is no mention of democracy or the principle of equality. Now, critics have called this law a betrayal of Israel's 1948 Declaration of Independence, which was actually modeled on the U.S. Declaration of Independence, which talks about equality of social and political rights for all inhabitants. But we can argue that that was never true, and that a state cannot, by definition, be Jewish, i.e. some form of ethnocracy, and democratic, a state where all citizens have equal rights. So the question is, how does the state do that legally? And I think it's important to understand the difference between nationality and citizenship as identification in the state, because this is really important. So Israeli citizens are citizens of the state, but they also have a national identity. And the national identity trumps the citizenship. So the Jews in Israel have a Jewish national identity, and they have rights that are determined by that national identity that put them above everybody else's national identity. So nationality, such as Jewish nationality, trumps citizenship. And this little factoid is the sort of legal reason and the key to institutionalized discrimination. I think you can imagine that this is pretty messy because the state uses the Nazi definition that you have to have one Jewish grandparent, and then by law you are a Jew. But the Orthodox rabbinate, which controls much of the civic and personal law, uses the you got to have a Jewish mother definition. So there's a lot of social and political nightmares and headaches around this. So Israel has two fundamental sets of rights, the core rights related to citizenship and the rights related to nationality. There are currently 57 laws that institutionally discriminate against non-Jews who don't have Jewish nationality, obviously. So what are these kinds of laws? They're focused around things like immigration. So Jews can come to Israel anytime, and Palestinians are totally unwelcome in a host of different ways. If you look at water, water is a core right, but its allocation and cost are related to nationality. If you look at land, 93% of the land in Israel is nationalized for Jewish use only and controlled by the Israel Land Authority and the Jewish National Fund. So my understanding, and I may not have this 100% right, you can correct me, is that if a Jewish person buys land, it's actually a 99-year lease that can be passed on to future generations, and the family is the guardian of the Jewish land. Palestinians obviously can't do this. So nationality in Israel is really what the rest of us think of as citizenship. And citizenship is really more like residency. And in Israel, nationality is really the only thing that counts. And Jews all over the world are viewed as potential members of this nation state. Now, I'm very interested in language. And when I look at this kind of history, I understand that Israel was established as a settler colonial state that had its core anchored in building a Jewish-only state. And this necessitated the ethnic cleansing of the indigenous population. However, the founding leadership was fully aware that they couldn't be really public about projecting that image in the world. So they needed to show that Israel is the only democracy in the Middle East. And this was not only for public relations, but it was also an existential necessity as the state was born. So towards that end, there was a considerable amount of effort made to create a veil of false democratic procedures that we see as we're talking about all these things. So I think when we examine the nation-state bill, it's important to remember that it does not infringe upon individual rights of citizens, but it does prevent collective national rights for non-Jews in a state where nationality trumps citizenship. Now, another language issue that I have with this bill is that it opens with, "The land of Israel is the historical homeland of the Jewish people." But it doesn't define what the land of Israel means. So is it the biblical land of Israel? Is it Mandate Palestine? Does it include the occupied territories? This has all been left open and is a pretty messy point that I think Fadi may talk about more. So let's go through the different pieces of the nation-state bill and some of the issues that I see as I read this. First of all, it was passed 62-55 in the Knesset, which means that the society is actually kind of fractured on this issue.
What was it? 62-55.
And it's broken up in terms of different sections. So the first section is called Basic Principles. And the first basic principle is the land of Israel is the historic homeland of the Jewish people in which the state of Israel was established. The second principle is the state of Israel is the national home of the Jewish people in which it fulfills its natural, cultural, religious, and historical right to self-determination. And the third principle is the right to exercise national self-determination in the state of Israel is unique to the Jewish people. So when I look at these three points, for me, this enshrines the right of national self-determination as unique to the Jewish people rather than to all the citizens, and thus it denies the history and legal rights and aspirations of Palestinians who have Israeli citizenship. Now, the second category is called symbols of the state. And I think the way to look at that is this is about not only messaging, but about how the state presents itself to its citizens and to the world. So the first thing is the name of the state is Israel, and then it describes the state flag, blue and white, yada, yada, yada. And then it talks about the state emblem, which is the menorah with the olive branch leaves. And then it says the state anthem is a hatikvah. And I just want us to think about what does it mean to have the state anthem be hatikvah. How many people know the translation of hatikvah? Okay, so let me just read the translation of hatikvah, and I want you to imagine that you're a Palestinian citizen of Israel, and this is your national anthem. As long as within our hearts the Jewish soul sings, as long as forward to the east to Zion looks the eye, our hope is not yet lost, it is 2,000 years old, to be a free people in our land, the land of Zion and Jerusalem. So this anthem effectively excludes 21% of the population, as I would argue do the other national symbols. And so this only contributes to a divisiveness and alienation of a fifth of the population within the state. Now the next section is called the capital of the state, and it states, Jerusalem, complete and united, is the capital of Israel. And we do know that that East Jerusalem was captured in the 67 war, and the, quote, unification of Jerusalem is actually a violation of international law and resolutions regarding occupied territories. The next section is language, and it says the state's language is Hebrew. And then it goes on to say the Arabic language has a special status in the state. And then there's a clause that I have no clue as to what it means, and it says, this clause does not harm the status given to the Arabic language before this law came into effect. When I read more about this, and I still couldn't really clarify it, everybody agreed that whatever this means, it's downgrading the Arabic from official language to a special status. So the messaging is not good for people who speak Arabic. The next section of this law is the ingathering of the exiles. And it states, the state will be open for Jewish immigration and the ingathering of exiles. So the translation of that message is that Israel is the state of the Jewish people who are defined as all exiles having come from this place many millennia ago, and that Jewish people are all welcome to come back and end their exile. And in some sense, the state really has no boundaries. So this is sort of the Zionist dream as a definition of Jewishness.
Right,
and it's
sure.
a reminder that Israel will be open to Jewish aliyah, the law of return, and not to Palestinian right of return. The next section is the connection to the Jewish people. And it says, the state will strive to ensure the safety of the members of the Jewish people in trouble or in captivity due to the fact of their Jewishness or their citizenship. The state shall act within the diaspora to strengthen the affinity between the state and the Jewish people who are in the diaspora. And the state shall act to preserve the cultural, historical, and religious heritage of the Jewish people among Jews in the diaspora. So I think this section is, first of all, acknowledging that anti-Semitism exists in the world, but it's also ignoring the positions of power and whiteness that Jews in the West, particularly, and in the U.S., currently find ourselves. It hints of an eternal Jewish victimization and the necessity of a place to go to be safe that is exclusively ours forever. And since, as I said, I'm fascinated by language, I think we have to ask, are we actually a people? Are we a collection of peoples? What is the criteria for membership in this peoplehood? How much has the Israeli state focused on its Ashkenazi background versus its Mizrahi and Sephardic citizens? And how has the growing power of the ultra-Orthodox and the shift to the right affected Israel's relationship with the diaspora, which is largely liberal-minded and very loose about the issue of inclusion? The next section is about Jewish settlement, and it says, the state views the development of Jewish settlement as a national value and will act to encourage and promote its establishment and consolidation. So what this is doing is advancing discrimination of land allocation policies, and it kind of hints at a potential colonization of the occupied territories. Then it says what the official calendar is, the Hebrew calendar alongside the Gregorian. And then it talks about Independence Day and Memorial Days. So Independence Day is the official national holiday. Memorial Day for the fallen in Israel's wars and Holocaust and Heroism Remembrance Day are official memorial days of the state. And this is in the context of the fact that commemorating the Nakba, the Palestinian experience of these Independence Days, is a civil offense and completely omitted from this statement. So I think looking at this bill as a whole, it is officially choosing Jewishness over democracy as an official policy, and it's really an outright dropping of the pretense of equality for Palestinian citizens. I think we can argue that the nation-state basic law is fundamentally anti-democratic, and it actually negates the main purpose behind the introduction of a democratic constitution, which is, you know, to anchor and determine the political community according to the principle that the residents living in this community are all equal citizens and constitute the sovereign state. So they're officially stating this isn't true for Israel. And I think it's important to remember that no country in the world today is defined as a democratic state where the constitutional identity is determined by ethnic affiliation. So I'll say that again slowly. No country in the world is defined as a democratic state where the constitutional identity is determined by ethnic affiliation. So Israel's asking to be different than everybody else. I think the basic law provides that self-determination will be exclusively to Jews, and thus it stands to justify the distinction between the realization of basic rights between Jews and non-Jews as a legitimate distinction, as opposed to an invalid discrimination that you can fight against, because now it's a legal thing to do. So despite the binational reality in Israel, the law promotes exclusive ethnic discrimination. I think politically, this represents the ascendancy of the ultranationalists. It's really a defining moment for Zionism, and it's an ideological fulfillment of the Jabotinsky kind of philosophy and ideology, and probably a path to full-blown ethnocracy. Now, when it was passed, Arab lawmakers called it apartheid, the end of democracy, the beginning of fascism. Yesh Atid, which is a centrist Israeli party, called it the poison pill for democracy. The Association for Civil Rights in Israel said that it establishes the legal basis for argument that Jews should enjoy privileges, subsidies, and rights because of their special status, and this is inherently racist. Adala said that it entrenches privileges of Jews, anchors discrimination of Palestinian citizens, and legitimizes exclusion, racism, and systemic inequality. Now, you may know that there are Druze folk living in Israel. This is a sect in Islam that have been loyal to the Israeli government. They fight in the Israeli army. And a former Druze Labor Party said, the national nationality law is a mark of Cain on the forehead of everyone who votes for it. I think the good news is that members of Israel's Arab minority led a mass protest in central Tel Aviv after it was passed, that the media reported tens of thousands of Jews and Arabs at this protest holding signs that read things like equality and Palestinian flags and performing Muslim prayers. And even some Druze spoke out and said they feel betrayed by the law, and several Druze military officers have said they will stop serving in response to it in the Israeli Defense Force. And so there's fears of a widespread insubordination amongst Druze. And one protester told Al Jazeera, "We have anti-democratic moves taking place in many things, towards gays, towards women, towards secularism, and towards Palestinians. This is turning into a fascist regime." Even some former top military and defense officials, including some from the Mossad and Shin Bet, so we're not talking about the liberal fringe here, came to the weekend's protest. And in the U.S., the Jewish Federation of North America, again, not a paragon of progressive thought, called this a racist policy that is a step back for all minorities. And the groups that represent Reform Jews in the United States also officially opposed the passing of this law. So now we're going to learn about the consequences of this law for Palestinian citizens with fibroids.
Hi, everybody. Thank you for having me, Jim, and thanks for everybody who's here. I want to start with an experiment. Let us imagine this. The supremacist alt-right wings in the United States mobilize and seek to amend the U.S. Constitution. They want to declare the country as the United States of the white people. A white country, but nonetheless democratic. And basically, it guarantees basic individual human rights to everybody, but collective and self-determination rights are bestowed upon the white community only. The minimal characteristics of such a constitutional order, and especially the white constitutional identity of the country, will be as follows. Every white individual will have the right to immigrate into the United States. The state has the right to maintain a white majority. The state's culture is informed by white culture and heritage. The holidays and symbols of the country are those that reflect white nationalism and the resurrection of the white national movement. The country shall aspire to maintain close ties with white people all over the world. Finally, which is true today, English is the only official language, which doesn't have to seem to be an issue in the United States. These characteristics must be balanced against the country's democratic identity. Individual human rights are to be defended so long as they do not contradict the interests enshrined in the white identity of the state, of the country. With that in mind, every citizen has the right to vote and get elected so long as they do not deny the country's constitutional identity. Individual equality is a sacred value, but the federal and state governments have the right to promote white settlement and other white interests. So, for example, it has the legal authority to establish white towns all over the place and encourage white migration to existing towns if it believes that there are demographic imbalances. Now, think about how this makes you feel. How this constitutional order that promises you individual human rights, but at the same time, it says that the constitutional identity of the state is that belongs to a group that is not you. If you feel good with it, then you feel good with the Israeli constitutional order as it is and as it has been since the start. If you're worried, I'm worried too about the place where I come from. Now back to real life. The nation state, and I might be saying stuff that I haven't said, but bear with me. The nation state basic law declares that the land of Israel, which is mandatory Palestine in my lexicon, is the historic homeland of the Jewish people, within which the state of Israel has been established. The right to self-determination is bestowed exclusively upon the Jewish population. Unified Jerusalem is the eternal capital of Israel. Hebrew is the only official language, downgrading Arabic into a language with special status. Israel is to maintain relationships with the Jewish diaspora. Jewish settlement is a national and constitutional value to be pursued, encouraged, and consolidated. Zionist and Jewish symbols are the symbols of the state. What is absent from this basic law is the Palestinian community, which makes up 20%, fifth of the population in the state. The basic law is a constitutional norm. Now, there's a lot of reason why there's no constitution, and there are several constitutional basic laws which are constitutional norms, and I can get into that in the Q&A. But that was a decision made in 1950. The basic law is a constitutional norm. It aims to define the constitutional identity of the state. Some have called it, and actually the MKs that initiated the process of enacting this law called it the constitution of the constitution. And as such, it entails a definition of who is the political community of the state. Who is the demos in the democracy? So democracy is ruled by the people. Who are the people? And it defines the people on ethnic basis and with clear affiliation with the Jewish people exclusively. It is the equivalent of a preamble to a constitution. In which the Constitution sets up its basic features and its mission. It explicitly defines the contours of we, the people, in ethnic terms, and excludes Palestinian citizens. And as a definer of the state's constitutional identity, it lacks basic features which are very telling. Democracy and equality. And it doesn't mention, like it has been said, those terms even once. There are many legal issues with the law, and I'll mention a few, and I can get into them in more detail in the Q&A. The basic law was passed by a narrow majority, and when we think about constitutional laws in a constitution, and especially the constitution of the constitution, we expect it to be passed through some form of consensus. Clearly, there is no consensus regarding these laws. And in fact, constitutional norms in Israel can be enacted like any other law. There are no special procedures, a requirement for special majorities. Think about the amendment of the U.S. Constitution powers and how complicated they are. And think about how the South African Constitution that took 4 years to enact through over-the-board representation from all the communities, and think about this law and how it was enacted. Second, the issue of exclusive self-determination rights. The law erases Palestinians' connection with their homeland and promotes a very revisionist, in my view, history in which basically the only indigenous population in this territory is the Jewish people. Consequently, only this population is entitled to self-determination rights and on an ethnic basis. Sovereignty is the business of the Jewish people, not the citizens of the state. So if we think about the United States again, and who's the sovereign in the United States, you'll answer me most probably, if you're not a white supremacist, you're going to say the United States citizens. In Israel, I can't give you that answer. It's going to be the Jewish people or the Jewish citizens, and basically you too, those of you who are Jews. So being Jewish, not necessarily only a citizen, is what counts constitutionally in order to be considered a part of the demos, the people. Non-Jews are automatically considered outsiders and otherized. Third point is the issue of group rights. The law acknowledges, in constitutional terms, the collective rights of the Jewish people. And it does not do the same for the Palestinian community. Jews as a collective are the constitutional subject of the political order as it stands today, and their interests are considered to be constitutional values that the state must align itself with. And here is the point about Arabic. Arabic has been officially an official language up until this point, and it's been downgraded. It was ba- based on mandatory laws before the establishment of Israel that were never annulled or revoked by the government, and despite a change that was made revoking the status of English as a official language. So up until 2018, Arabic was an official language. But I will explain the article that you are confused about, which is a very complex point. Fourth, the issue of Jewish settlement. So the state shall promote Jewish settlement, and this is now a constitutional value. That doesn't mean that it wasn't a policy before. Historically, this meant the establishment of Jewish-only towns and include incentives-based land and housing policies, and what has been called Judaizing the space. Mm-hmm. Basically, the part about demographic imbalance, we see that in Jerusalem and in the north, where you have more than 20% Arab and Palestinian presence and Syrian presence in the occupied areas in the north. And here we've seen municipal plans that explicitly state that we need to do something about demography. For example, the 2030 plan for Jerusalem talks about maintaining a 30-70 demographic ratio. And that's part of a municipal plan that planning bodies and authorities are working toward. Think about the reality and why there are no building initiatives in East Jerusalem for the welfare of the community, and why a lot of people are being forced to move out. But we talked about the law, but it is very important to me to note here that we cannot speak about this law without speaking about the constitutional order as a whole and the values that the state has pursued since its establishment. In many respects, the law is basically a declaration of what's been being done up until this point, but it entails some language that seems to be a step closer to colonialism and apartheid. So the left-right debate about the law. I mean, you already know that there were even... first of all, 55 of the Knesset members did not like the law. 13 of whom are Palestinian MKs, which is understandable, but what's with the rest? It's not because they're against the idea or the constitutional notion of a Jewish and democratic state. Right and left Zionism in Israel both support the notion of a Jewish and democratic state. I mean, from Meretz, which is the far left, to the furthest right you can think of, which is now Bennett and the Jewish Home Party. Basically, the debate is about the balance between these two values. What balance should be struck between Jewish and democratic for the left? And we can learn that from a lot of the reservations. So each Knesset member has the right to basically submit reservations to the law as it is being voted on. And a lot of the leftist parties... For example, the first reservation of the Meretz party was the redundant law. And this is telling because it's redundant because that's what's actually happening. So we don't need to embarrass ourselves and showcase this law, and basically, which acts as a mirror to the international community saying we're not a liberal democracy. But they believe that they can be portrayed as a liberal democracy, the way that the left-wing governments have been doing for so long, basically at the policy level, without really declaring a lot of these issues in an official legal document. So the left thinks that this law kind of infringes on the liberal democratic image of the state. The right thinks that this law is needed because basically, the left and the elite in the Supreme Court has given too much weight to democratic values at the expense of the Jewish character of the state, and this rectifies it. But it doesn't really do a whole lot, because the same judges and justices at the Supreme Court can continue basically doing the same shtick they've been doing so far, but as an addition, they're packing the courts. And they're packing the courts with conservative justices, and I'll get to one instance of application, of legal application of this law, to show how some judges are more than happy to jump on the opportunity to shuffle the cards of jurisprudence in Israel in accordance with this law. So, the implication. A lot of this is speculative, but also based on, you know, current events or not so far history. So, the collective interest, the most immediate one is that the collective interest of the Palestinians, and I'm talking about Palestinian citizens of Israel, are not accounted for. Basically, elevating the Jewish communal interest into a constitutional norm and aligning the state's interest with the Jewish community's interest basically means that basic rights can now be balanced against these interests. And the way it has been played out so far is the family unification ban. Palestinians from both sides of the Green Line cannot, if they marry, cannot live in Israel. And the spouse that is not an Israeli citizen, a Palestinian from the occupied territories, cannot be nationalized, cannot receive Israeli citizenship. And the most that they can get is temporary residence, which has to be, in some cases, renewed every 6 months. And in cases where people have been doing this for almost 20 years now, every 2 years. So I know that personally because my aunt is married to a Palestinian from Beit Jala. They have 5 children. They married right when the policy went into effect. And he's been basically renewing his status every, you know, period of time. And they have 5 little girls. I mean, not so little. One is now 18. And every time their father goes to the Ministry of Interior in order to renew his residency status, the girls are shut down. Because there's a chance that he's not going to come back. Mm-hmm. And it happened. So this is just like an indication of like the psychological effects of these policies. And this is now being, so this is a legal order, which is temporary and is renewed every year. It's not a permanent law yet, which I think is going to be soon. But Ayelet Shaked, the Minister of Justice, is basically saying now that the rationale behind the law is demographic. And it's okay. These grounds are okay because Jewish interests, human rights, we can balance them one against the other, and demographic interests should trump basically right to family life. Back in 2006 and in 2012, Adala and other organizations litigated these the case and before the Supreme Court, both time lost because then the rationale was security. It shifted now. Other example is basically there's new talk, not so new, about funding policies for culture that are conditional on loyalty. Basically, if you're a director and you've just directed a movie which has criticism of Israel, you're out. And what has been called, right, you have free speech, right, and you can do everything, but we have the freedom to fund. And these two newly kind of components of a new discourse of freedom of speech versus the freedom to fund is being promoted hard by Miri Regev, the Minister of Culture and Sports. Limitations on civil and political rights, and here's the JVP connection. For example, Knesset members cannot be invited by you guys to speak at your events and you cannot fund them, basically. According to new rules by the Knesset ethics, ethical rules, there are a 20-group list that support and call for boycott and sanctions, support the BDS movement, and JVP is on it. One Knesset member, Yusuf Jabarin, was invited by a chapter of JVP somewhere, and basically they would fund his flight, his stay in the United States, and he was denied by the Knesset the right to do so. So we have now a new petition against that. Parties cannot form around the agenda of rejecting the identity, the Jewish identity of the state, and basically saying that if my party and the list I'm running with calls for a state for all its citizens, basically negating the idea of a Jewish state, the Central Committee, Elections Committee, can basically disqualify me. And that's based on another law that would been enacted in 85 and then amended in 2002. And basically, if you're already in the Knesset, you cannot propose bills that denies Israel as the state of the Jewish people. One example was MKs from the Balat party, MK Jamal Zahalka, Hanin Zorbi, and Juma Asbarga, who basically, as a response to the basic law, said, okay, we have another suggestion. A basic law, state for all its citizens. And it basically, Jews and Palestinians, Jews and Arabs live together as equals, group rights, individual rights, everything you would probably agree with. The Knesset Presidium, which is the speaker and his deputies, vetoed the law. It was not even brought to a vote, and because of a small rule in the bylaws of the Knesset that basically says individual MKs cannot submit and introduce bills that negate Israel as the state of the Jewish people, and this was construed as doing so. So that's how, this is part of the ways how Jewish and democratic kind of interact in real life. Of course, there are a lot of other spaces where that happens, but we don't have the time. One anecdote, recently, terrorism victims, Jewish terrorism victims, submitted a lawsuit against Hamas, and it was just ruled by a judge in the District Court of Jerusalem. He basically, in addition to the compensation awarded to any victim of terrorism, he decided to add a component of punitive damages, and which, you know, it could be justified, but the justification in this case was the nation-state basic law. And because the law really aims to protect Jews wherever they are, and the state of Israel failed to do so in this case, Hamas should pay more. I'm not against Hamas paying, but I'm just saying that the question would be, what if a Palestinian terrorism victim came to court, what kind of compensation they would get? I'm going to take a few more minutes because I want to discuss the Arabic aspect and maybe just also the influence regarding the Palestinian territories. Arabic has been an official language in mandatory laws. It was considered to be official on an official level, but policy and practice really fell short from that standard. We went to court about several issues. One of them, signs in the streets, especially in mixed cities where Arabic was nowhere to be found. The court agreed with us in 2002. Now, what that article says is that whatever the status quo was, the de facto status of the Arabic language, we're not harming it. We're just downgrading the de jure, or the official definition of Arabic from an official language to a special status language. But the practice continues as it was. But since the law There are a few stories about Arabic being taken away down from signs in the street in certain areas. And I expect this trend to continue given who the Minister of Transportation is. Land issues for Palestinian citizens of Israel are, I mean, you discussed it, I'm not going to go over it, is a very big issue because between 40 to 60% of privately held lands by a Palestinian citizen have been confiscated since the establishment of the state. 93% of the land in Israel is state held. In 2000, the court declared as illegal the establishment of a Jewish-only town that did not allow a Palestinian citizen in. And it was explicit because Zionism, because Jewish values, Zionist Jewish values, and etc. But then the practice continued despite this fact. But the right believes that not enough. It's not enough. So basically, the Article 7 of the law comes to kind of contradict and revoke that Supreme Court ruling. But then there is the issue of the occupied territories. True, it's a constitutional norm that ostensibly is supposed to be applied only within the borders of the state or the internationally recognized borders. But from what we heard in the Knesset debate, a lot of like Smotrich and other Knesset members says, we don't want a declaration here. We want something that has an effect in the real world. And part of it is really settlements, illegal settlements in the West Bank. One indication, an official indication of this, is another case we're litigating right now, which is concerns a law that's been passed before the basic law that aims to regularize and legalize illegal settlements in the West Bank that were built on private Palestinian lands. And basically it says if we built it with good faith, then we can confiscate the land, and that would be okay. The state response to our petition in that case was that the Knesset has the authority to enact this law, despite the fact that it's abroad, basically, not within Israel. But one of the reasons is one of Zionism's basic values is Jewish settlement all over the place where we consider it to be the land of Israel. So the West Bank is the land of Israel, and we should be entitled to settle there, and the Knesset should be allowed to enact such a law. To conclude, I talked about law, and we've kind of really neglected one major aspect of this law. And I think we need to recognize here that constitutional norms do not only have legal consequences. People socialized under certain constitutional order that really is supportive of ethnic hierarchy and espouses ethnic supremacy, these people become less tolerant towards those who are defined as the inferior other. In the minds of the Jewish Israelis today, the state is their own. Palestinians or Palestinian presence is either a hindrance on the right or tolerated on the left. And so the socio-political consciousness will continue to develop, and this law really has a huge influence on that. And really shrinks the space for coexistence and sharing the space, not only politically, but especially in social terms. So therefore, I would end with this law goes really a long way in creating a constitutional environment under which apartheid, colonialism, ethnic supremacy, and discrimination, which is the best of those four, become more tolerable, if not justified, only in the name of protecting what is the Jewish state.
You have been listening to Alice Rothschild and Fadi Curry speaking on the Israeli Nation State Law at the Community Church of Boston. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.